For listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Robin, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Sunday, October 12th issue of the Viewpoint section of the Buffalo News on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And first, Manosphere is bad for boys and even worse for democracy. By Kevin Liverpool. 15-year-old Owen Cooper made history to become the youngest male to win an Emmy Award. In the Netflix series Adolescence, Owen plays the role of a 13-year-old schoolboy who is arrested after the murder of a girl in his school. As we'll follow the events leading up to the crime, the award-winning series forces us to confront legitimate insecurities that many of teenage boys face, from lack of physical prowess to emotional disconnection from their fathers. It also exposes how easily young men seeking comfort in their computers can be pulled into online spaces that normalize misogyny and rage, a pipeline enabled by a failure of tech policy. At the center of this danger lies the Manosphere, a global network of influencers whose words can radicalize young men and channel their frustrations into violence. But this is more than a social crisis affecting some young men. It is a growing threat to the democratic values of equality and tolerance that keep us all safe. Like the crime series, we have already seen where this can lead in real life. Recently, French authorities charged a teenager connected to the incel subculture with terrorism, marking the country's first such case of gender-based violence, a case built on the young man's conspiracy to harm women. This should not be seen as an isolated incident, but as a symptom of a broader ideological problem. While toxic for the young men it ensnares, the Manosphere's deeper danger lies in the corrosion of the fundamental values of democracy. These male-dominated online spaces reinforce rigid traditional masculine norms. Misogynistic messages poison the minds of young men, weaponizing their frustrations. They offer a seductively simple answer to complex feelings of loneliness: blame women. In 2014, Elliot Roger fatally stabbed 3 people before going on a shooting spree to kill 3 more and injure 14 others. In his manifesto, he wrote, "All of my suffering in this world has been at the hands of humanity, particularly women," blaming even his childhood crush for his violent hatred of women. This blame can then be refined into a hatred for the very institutions, such as education, government, and the media, that are pillars of a functioning civil society, breeding a generation that rejects the pluralistic ideals necessary for democracy to thrive. The Manosphere is a pathway to violence, where online hate is turned into real-world violence. The French case is a direct example, but the trail of blood stretches back to attacks in Toronto, Isla Vista, and beyond. These digital communities don't just vent, they strategize. They provide twisted justification and promote a culture of martyrdom that glorifies retribution. The leap from dehumanizing rhetoric on a forum to physical acts of terror is shorter than we imagine. The Manosphere is not neutral and can serve as a pipeline to extremist ideologies. While its entry point is often resentment of women, its logic inevitably expands. The same frameworks of hatred used against women are easily applied to minorities, migrants, and LGBTQ+ individuals. The Center on Extremism, COE, explains that the fear that women's equality undermines men's status is just a step away from seeing all demands for equality as threats to white male dominance. This exposes the symbols between misogyny and white supremacy, both connected by a deep-seated loathing of women. And this matters because the status of women has long been a litmus test for the health of democracy. A recent study by the Georgetown Institute for Women, Peace, and Security found that women's equality is strongly correlated with election integrity, freedom of association and assembly, and checks on executive power. In other words, when women's rights erode, so too do the foundations of democratic governance. Some argue that we might be overestimating the influence of the manosphere, as many of its users selectively choose what resonates with them and disregard what doesn't. Indeed, not every frustrated young man online is a criminal. Not all criticism of society is extremist. Yet history shows that even small, seemingly fringe groups can eventually reshape society in harmful, authoritarian, or destructive ways. When Adolf Hitler joined the German Workers' Party, which later became the Nazi Party, he was the 55th member. We do not have to wait for a movement to gain a large following to see the potential trajectory it might take. Ignoring the manosphere is a luxury we cannot afford. Combating it requires a proactive, multi-sectoral effort that must include a robust tech policy framework. Tech companies must move beyond reactive content moderation and proactively redesign their algorithms to de-amplify hateful content rather than recommending it. They must consistently enforce their own terms of service against organized hate and misogyny, subjecting their enforcement to independent audits for transparency. Furthermore, they should invest in redirect initiatives that algorithmically offer resources for mental health and positive mentorship to users searching for harmful keywords. Governments must move beyond a hands-off approach. They should legislate mandatory safety by design standards for platforms, compelling them to conduct and publish risk assessments on how platforms might facilitate radicalization. Legislators must also strengthen laws that hold platforms accountable for knowingly profiting from the algorithmic amplification of extremist content. This must be coupled with integrating digital literacy into education to build resilience against manipulation, and most importantly, offering young men positive models of manhood built on respect rather than hatred and blame. Our collective safety and the future of our democratic values may just depend on it. Kevin Liverpool is a Public Voices Fellow on Prevention of Child Sexual Abuse with the Op-Ed Project. He works as a partnership specialist with No Means No Worldwide, an international nonprofit on a mission to end sexual violence against women and children globally. And that's all they wrote. And now, Threats Against Judges Have Crossed the Line by Mary Ellen Klass. The destruction of South Carolina Circuit Court Judges Diane Goldstein's home in a fiery inferno over the weekend immediately led to speculation that it was an act of political violence. South Carolina officials are still investigating, and they said on Monday that there is no evidence to indicate that the cause of the explosion was intentionally set. But it says something about this moment that a judge being violently targeted was so easy to imagine. According to annual data compiled by the U.S. Marshals Office Service, there has been an increase in threats against federal judges since Trump retook office. Judges have also reported receiving unsolicited pizzas delivered to their personal residences, including some in the name of the murdered son of a New Jersey federal judge. A judge close to Goldstein said FITS News after the fire that she has had multiple death threats over the years. Goldstein is just one of the many judges who have been lambasted by Trump administration officials for issuing rulings the White House doesn't like. Last month, she imposed a temporary restraining order, blocking the state from turning over its voter list to the Department of Justice. The ruling drew an immediate rebuke from Harmet Dillon, the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the Department of Justice. This at the Justice Department's at Civil Rights will not stand for a state court judge's hasty nullification of our federal voting laws, Dillon wrote on X. I will allow nothing to stand in the way of our mandate to maintain clean voter rolls. Goldstein's ruling was overturned by a unanimous Supreme Court, but if Dillon believed in her argument and did not intend for harm or violence to befall those who fall with whom she disagrees, then her post was reckless. She should know that in these violent times, such hyperbolic criticism can stir emotions and escalate into personal risk for judges. Over the weekend, the president's deputy chief of staff, Stephen Miller, used even more extreme language when he suggested that the ruling of an Oregon judge who stopped the deployment of troops to the state was part of an organized terrorist attack. Miller is a central character here, not only because of his proximity to the president, but because he has accelerated his attacks on judges whose decisions go against the president's political agenda. After District Court Judge Karen Immergut temporarily halted the deployment of National Guard troops to Portland, Miller wrote this chilling post on X. The issue before us now is very simple and clear. There is a large and growing movement of left-wing terrorism in this country. It is well organized and funded. It is shielded by far-left Democratic judges, prosecutors, and attorney generals. The only remedy is to use legitimate state power to dismantle terrorism and terror networks. There are simply no facts to support these claims. In fact, research on political extremism led by the University of Dayton professors Art Gibson and Paul Becker has found that most domestic terrorism and terrorists in the U.S. are politically on the right, and right-wing attacks account for the vast majority of fatalities from domestic terrorism. Immergut is a conservative judge who was appointed by Trump. She called out his false claims that Portland was beset by violence and concluded the president's determination was simply untethered to the facts. But Miller and President Trump have mastered the art of false equivalencies and half-truths so that if they say something enough on social media, people will start to believe it. Following Miller's lead, Trump lashed out against Immergut on Sunday. It's fair game to criticize a judge's reasoning or logic, but if a conservative judge appointed by this president can be attacked as a shield for left-wing terrorism, the U.S. judicial branch is in a precarious place. That precarity should worry everyone, especially any elected official who swore an oath to the Constitution. Politicians from both parties say they abide by the rule of law, but essential to the rule of law is the independence of the judiciary. Courts are supposed to be neutral arbiters in any dispute. They are a check on power, including the overreach of the executive branch. Any of us may sit before a judge someday, and a fair and impartial court is our best hope that our constitutional rights and liberties will be protected. Yet Republicans have not pushed back on the White House's anti-judiciary rhetoric. South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster, a Trump ally, was silent when Dylan suggested nothing will stand in the way of Goldstein's ruling. When state investigators said that arson was not a factor at the judge's home, he could have urged respect for the judiciary and decried the threats she'd previously received. Instead, he simply urged the public to exercise good judgment and avoid sharing unverified information. Republicans should loudly call out dehumanizing rhetoric against all judges, not only those who agree with Alexander Hamilton, not only those they agree with. Alexander Hamilton explained why in Federalist 78, when he warned, "No man can be sure that he may not be tomorrow the victim of a spirit of injustice by which he may be a gainer today." Hamilton wrote that the independent judiciary would be an essential safeguard against the effects of occasional ill humors in the society. But a judiciary cowed by the dangerous rhetoric of a president and his top deputy is no longer independent. It is also not much of a safeguard. And that's all they wrote in the Bloomberg opinion. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Viewpoint section of the Buffalo News on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And now, from Frama Harrop with Creator Syndicate, "Trump must stop trampling on our leading universities." In the course of 3 days, six U.S.-based scientists have won Nobel Prizes. Every one of them studied or now works at America's public universities. Five are affiliated with or educated by California's system of for higher education. President Trump's assault on universities, both public and private, targets the engines of American greatness. He pinned much of it on the college's failure to defend free speech and stop unruly student behavior, some denigrating into anti-Semitism. Point taken. Over in the biology department, immunologists Mary Brunkow and Fred Ramsden are sharing the Nobel Prize in Medicine with Shimon Sakaguchi. Brunkow studied at the University of Washington in Princeton. Ramsdell got both his bachelor's degree and doctorate from the University of California, first at San Diego, then at Los Angeles. Sakaguchi teaches at Japan's Osaka University. As for physics, three scientists, one British, one French, and one American, shared the Nobel Prize. All three, however, are now associated with UC campuses at Berkeley or Santa Barbara. The American, John Martinez, earned all of his degrees at Berkeley. They won the Nobel for having discovered, bear with me, macroscopic quantum mechanical tunneling and the energy quantization in an electric circuit. And one of the three scientists just awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry is Omar Yaghi, who occupies the chair in chemistry at Berkeley. Born in Amman, Jordan, Yaghi obtained his undergraduate degree at the State University of New York's Albany campus. His PhD came from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Our colleges and universities are a reason why, if California were on its own country, it would have the world's fourth largest economy. To think that Trump is threatening its public universities with layoffs, budget cuts, and loss of federal grants. He's trying to freeze about $584 million in grants at UCLA alone. That's in addition to his attempted $1 billion shakedown over unrest at the UCLA campus. With an economy larger than Japan's, small wonder there's a move in California to take over federal funding for scientific research with its own. Specifically, state lawmakers talk about putting a $23 billion bond measure on the 2026 ballot to replace lost federal dollars. If voters passed it, that would give California the wherewithal to make grants and loans to its own universities and research companies. California would, in effect, be bypassing the National Institutes of Health. The NIH is the world's biggest funder of medical research. And who did Trump put in charge of the NIH? Health Secretary Bobby Kennedy Jr., an anti-vax ignoramus. Excuse me, skeptic, who is mentally many cards short of a full deck. At least 24 University of California and California State University campuses have lost NIH training grants. UC also already runs 6 academic health centers. If Californian taxpayers take over that funding, universities in other states should not expect to receive a dime of it. That said, other states share these concerns. Washington and Oregon have joined California in setting up a coalition to review scientific data and make recommendations on vaccines. An alliance with similar goals, probably less money, is being set up on the East Coast. Harvard and Yale do have impressive endowments. What the great universities in the Trump-voting heartland are going to do, I can't guess. In sum, many of the smartest people in the country are being sat on by the political dunces. How dumb can America get? Trump is testing us for an answer. And that's all they wrote. And now, playing victims to sue betrays real survivors and the public trust. From the Creator Syndicate by Susan Estrich. There's a special place in hell for phony victims who take money from settlements meant for the legitimate victims of sexual abuse. Ahead of them, however, come the lawyers who make such scams work and pocket as much as half of the settlement themselves. If an investigation conducted by the Los Angeles Times holds up, hell will have to make room for the lawyers and clients of the DTLA, Downtown LA Law Group, a firm best known for doing car accident cases. The DTLA managed to sign up more than 2,700 people to sue LA County for sex abuse in juvenile facilities and foster homes, which resulted in a record settlement of $4 billion, with DTLA receiving nearly half the money paid to each individual. How did they do it? After so many years in this field, I know, or know of, most of the experienced sexual misconduct lawyers who take on massive task of putting together a case like this. DTLA is not one of them. So how did they get so many clients? According to the Times investigators, they violated state law by paying them, using vendors who hung outside the county benefits office and offered cash to people on behalf of DTLA to sue the county for sex abuse. Some of those paid to sue said they had been abused but didn't plan to sue until they received cash. Some had never been abused at all and were told to fabricate tales of abuse. Last spring, the county agreed to a record-breaking $4 billion settlement with 11,000 plaintiffs, about a quarter of whom were represented by DTLA, dating back to the 1950s. It is the largest sexual abuse settlement in history. Because the country doesn't have records that go back that far, they relied on the lawyers to do the vetting. In this case, lawyers stand to collect more than $1 billion in fees. The whole thing just stinks, says John Manley, one of the most respected and experienced sexual misconduct lawyers in the business and a lead attorney in the settlements against USA Gymnastics Dr. Larry Nassar and the USC gynecologist George Tyndall. It looks to me like a third of these cases are totally bull, blank, blank, and the county is paying for no reason. There is a reason California law prevents the practice of capping or paying people to bring lawsuits. It's because it invites fraud. I don't blame the poor and sick people who take $100 or $200 nearly as much as I do the lawyers who pay them. I have been advocating for the victims of sexual assault since I graduated from law school more than 40 years ago. I helped to found the Victim Rights Law Center in Boston, the first organization devoted to ensuring that the victims of sexual assault have legal representation. I believe in listening to victims, but I know painfully well that not everyone claiming to be a victim is telling the truth. We depend on lawyers to be the gatekeepers to the system, to vet their cases and confirm the facts before they bring the case. That is particularly true in sexual abuse cases, where just bringing a case against a defendant, even without any settlement or adjudication on the merits, can destroy a reputation. It is also true in cases like this one, where it is not the guilty individual, but the rest of us, the public, that is paying the tab. For its part, DTLA is denying everything. They have hired Mitch Langberg, a friend of mine and a highly respected defamation lawyer, to protect their reputation. He has his work cut out for him. Since the LA Times story broke a few days ago, there have been calls for an audit of the settlement and an investigation of the firm. Both are essential. And that's all they wrote. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Viewpoint section of the Buffalo News on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And now, In My View, by Eric Wyant, who works for Erie County and believes that citizen involvement is important. We act in the faith that service matters. When you skip forward when your community, will you step forward when your community asks? In every generation, men and women without titles or positions of authority have chosen to answer yes. One of those choices is part of my own family story. It was made by Philip Nicholas Main, my great-great-great-great-grandfather, a soldier in the Revolutionary War who bore the scars and memories of that struggle. Philip was born on October 17, 1747, in Gloucester County, New Jersey. When the colonists declared independence, he was no general or statesman, just an ordinary man, 28 years old, married, and living beyond the Alleghenies in the Monongahela Valley, then still part of Virginia. In August 1776, he enlisted in Captain Andrew Wagoner's company of the 12th Virginia Regiment under Colonel James Wood. He served 4 years as a private. He entered the war in the thick of the Northern Campaign, fighting at Brandywine and Germantown, and enduring the brutal winter of 1777 to 1778 at Valley Forge. It was there, serving as a bodyguard to General George Washington, that family lore places him in an unusual role. On occasion, it was said he acted as the general's food taster. Whether legend or fact, it is a reminder that surface office often takes forms history never recounts. But not even his proximity to Washington could shield him from British guns. On October 3rd, 1777, at the Battle of Germantown, during the assault on the British headquarters at Cliveden, he was struck by a musket ball that destroyed his right eye. When the war ended, Philip Maine settled in North Sewickley Township, Pennsylvania, and raised a family on 200 acres of farmland. Four of his sons would serve in the War of 1812, carrying his tradition of service forward. He left no monuments, only the living legacy of a neighbor, husband, and father. Tested at Valley Forge, scarred at Germantown, and rooted in a new nation, this ordinary man's grit, sacrifice, and resolve reminds us that even the humblest life can impact history in quiet, enduring ways. As we approach our semi-quincentennial on 2026, marking 250 years since the start of the Revolution, I understand Philip's choice not as a footnote in history, but as proof that the legacy of our founding lives in the choices we make today. Like his generation, we face extraordinary times that call for ordinary citizens to step forward. The world is still recovering from the disruptions of the pandemic. Our nation wrestles with polarization, and local communities face challenges that test our resilience. Your family story may start with a different war or a different kind of service, but my thread is the same as yours. The lesson is that service does not wait for perfect conditions, nor is it just the responsibility of those in elected office. It belongs to the ordinary people who choose to act in times of need. Philip Maine could not know what difference his service would make, and neither can we. Yet we act in faith that our service matters. Today, the question is not how we honor our history, but how we answer it. The liberty his generation secured survives because ordinary citizens continue to step forward. The promise of 250 years depends on whether our generation is willing to answer yes. My view is the first person column open to all Western New Yorkers. If your article is selected for publication, a photo of you is required. Email submissions to editpage@buffnews.com. And that's all he wrote. And now, from the Buffalo Next section, also Sunday, October 12th, 2025. Spotlight wages. Paychecks in region are growing more slowly. By David Robinson. Our paychecks aren't growing as fast as they used to. That is the big takeaway from the latest federal wage data, which show that paychecks across the region grow at their slowest pace in 5 years during the first quarter. The average weekly wage of workers in the Buffalo-Niagara region, a figure that reflects only not not only hourly earnings, but how many hours a worker puts in, grew by 3.5% to $1,335 during the first quarter. That is a little better than the 2.4% increase in consumer prices during the same period. That was the smallest increase since a 2.7% gain during the first quarter of 2020, just before the COVID-19 pandemic spawned a worker shortage that pushed average wages up far beyond their usual rate. The average weekly wage jumped by 7.5% in 2022 and by 8.2% in 2023. Wage growth slowed to a little more than 4% last year and has continued to cool as the competition for workers has eased and the pace of hiring has slowed. Revised federal data released last month showed that the region lost jobs during February and March, even though the unemployment rate has remained low at around 4%. Wage growth was even stronger in the private sector, with the average weekly wage rising by 3.9% during the first quarter, which was roughly in line with the increases during each of the two previous years. And that's all they wrote. And now, the cover story from the next edition. Section C. Startups. 11th 43 North draws finalists from far and wide. By Mike Petro. What proof that 43 North has become one of the most prominent contests for early stage companies in the U.S. and maybe even on an international stage? Just look at this year's 15 semifinalists for one of five $1 million prizes in this year's startup competition. The latest cohort includes two companies from London, one returning to the 43 North stage as a semifinalist, and four startups from the West Coast. There's also one from Oklahoma, Miami, and Kentucky. For the second straight year, many of the startups leverage artificial intelligence to help solve a problem. This year's group spans industries from clean tech and fintech to advanced manufacturing and digital health. Many of the companies have established investors, partnerships, and networks, and have gone through an array of startup accelerators. This year's cohort already has raised over $12.7 million. Their notable investor affiliations include the Y Combinator, a 16Z Techstars, Neo Accelerator, Greentown Labs, Alchemist Accelerator, Flybridge, ZeoClap Capital, and Funders Club. It should make for one of the most competitive finals round for the startup pitch competition, now in its 11th year, with finals being held October 16th at Chase Performing Arts Center. They also will compete for the $25,000 People's Choice Award. The semifinalists will take place the day before prior at Seneca One. One of the semifinalists is now headquartered in Buffalo. Integral Health is an AI-driven behavioral and mental health platform whose founder, MJ Che, moved to Buffalo from San Francisco earlier this year to help create traction for the startup. This comes a year after Buffalo food tech startup Food Nerd won the competition, and three startups from Western New York were part of the semifinals. A panel of more than 100 venture capitalists from across North America helped narrow the approximately 900 applicants to 15 semifinalists. The panel reviewed submissions and engage with founders to help select this year's top contenders. One of the semifinalists, Thedo Neurotech of Chicago, dropped out after being selected. Backed by state funding, 43 North has become a driving force in Buffalo, building a startup ecosystem. In addition to the $1 million investment, companies selected for 43 North's Year 11 cohort will receive mentorship, office space, access to a broad network of investors, and resources to help them scale. Winning companies must move to Buffalo for at least 1 year, and the state receives a 5% ownership stake in each winner. Since 2014, 43 North has invested in 74 companies, created more than 3,000 jobs globally, and raised more than $1 billion in capital. These founders are tackling big challenges across diverse industries, and their choice to compete for a place in Buffalo is a testament to the energy and opportunity taking root in our region, said 43 North President Colleen E. Heidinger. Here's a look at the 43 North semifinalists. CellSense, New York City. Founder CEO, Aradhita Parasampurua. When? 2022. Full-time employees, 4. What it does. Transforms algae and cellulose into compostable beads that eliminate microplastics across the fashion and cosmetic industries. Over the summer, the company earned grants totaling $170,000 from the Sage Impact Entrepreneurship Program. It's also a participant in Greentown Labs, a large climate tech and energy incubator. Cozy Care, Swansea, United Kingdom. Founder CEO, Lauren Bell. When? 2018. Full-time employees, 10. What it does? A returning startup to the 43 North competition. It makes medical devices that offer itch relief and an alternative to scratching and infection management for those living with eczema or chronic itch. Cozy Care has won a number of awards in the UK, including the Mayor of London Entrepreneur of the Year and the Santander Entrepreneur of the Year. Felix Fusion from San Francisco. Founder CEO, Ash Yousefi. When? 2024. Full-time employees, 2. What it does. An AI-powered aggregator helping mid-sized vendors win government contracts. The company has been funded by the Alchemist Accelerator, a program that provides seed investment and it participated in the Y Combinator, an accelerator and venture capital firm funding early stage startups. Flow, New Haven, Connecticut. Founder CEO, David Dalal. When? 2017. Full-time employees, 5. What it does. Offering a cost-effective and eco-friendly solution for ice and snow management on roofs. Flow won $100,000 in Avnet's ASUEO IoT competition and earned a FORGE Clean Tech Product Development Grant in 2023. It's been supported by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Yale University. Fly Connect from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Founder CEO, John Morad. When? 2024. Full-time employees, 2. What it does. A marketplace where AI agents are hired to complete business tasks on demand. The company launched a year ago with the help of an initial grant to help automate email, SMS, and phone outreach use AI to match product or service to leads and personalize messages to increase engagement and drive results. Greenlit from New York City. Founder CEO, Ian Grant. When? 2022. Full-time employees, 5. What it does. An AI-enabled back-office platform for the media, filmmaking, and entertainment industry that simplifies workflows, contracting, financing, tax incentives, and revenue management. It participated in the Raise the Stakes AI competition this year in Europe and startup incubator TechStars and raised $50,000 seed round in 2024. Imaginario.ai from London. Founder CEO Jose Puga. When? 2022. Full-time employees? 7. What it does. Offering a multinodal video productivity engine and AI agents that make it easy to curate, understand, and alter video footage. The company's key investors include Comcast, 216 Capital, TechStars, Blue Lake, and Earthling, which were all part of an $800,000 pre-seed round raised in 2024. Its roster of strategic angels include AI engineers from Meta and Google. Integral Health from Buffalo. Founder CEO MJ Che. When? 2020. Full-time employees? 5. What it does. Leveraging AI to integrate behavioral health with primary care. Aiming to improve patient engagement and outcomes through personalized data-driven mental health support. The company recently signed Independent Health as its latest enterprise customer, helping make the transition from San Francisco to Buffalo possible, and it recently closed a $3 million seed funding round. Kinometrics from Alexandria, Virginia. Founder CEO, Davina Desai. When? 2017. Full-time employees, 3. What it does. Using AI to power clinical decision support, helping hospitals accurately identify patient risk and reduce harm, cost, and burnout, starting with inpatient falls. Investors include Virginia Venture Partners, an innovation partnership corps, Commonwealth Commercialization Fund. The company participated in TechStars LA and Angel Star Ventures, won the Judges' Choice Award at the AI Med Global Summit, and raised a $118,000 round in 2024. Legacy from San Diego. Founder, Shinvanjali Singh. When? 2024. Full-time employees, 9. What it does. Providing a data layer that enables health systems to give personalized care by learning about the patient and turning that into an actionable insights for the clinical care team. The company raised a $50,000 round in 2024 with investors including Rue Institute at Northeastern University and Neo Accelerator. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Viewpoints and Next section of the Buffalo News on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Continuing in the 1143 North article, Modica from Louisville, Kentucky. Founder, J.D. Mitchell. When? 2017. Full-time employees? 5. What it does. A maker of mixologist-crafted cocktail and mocktail mixers using clean ingredients. The company's investors include Key Horse Capital and others such as SKU and Startout Growth Lab. It launched a crowdfunding campaign on WeFunder and raised $112,000 in late-stage venture capital. Precious Creatures from Portland, Oregon. Founder CEO Robin Young, when? 2023. Full-time employees, 2. What it does. A maker of healthy pet food, as well as pet supplements and treats. The company's mission is to get more dogs eating its fresh and homemade food, and one day it hopes to own a ranch for rescues that can enjoy the food daily. Rad Employ, out of New York City. Founder CEO, Joel Holsforth. When, 2024. Full-time employees, 3. What it does, a radiology staffing platform that leverages its conversational AI to connect radiology professionals with large hospital systems. The company has raised around $170,000 with investors like Andreessen Horowitz or A16Z, a privately held venture capital firm. Solemn Health from San Francisco. Founder, CEO Juan Pablo Montoya. When? 2024. Full-time employees, 3. What it does. Automating intake, insurance verification, and scheduling for therapy clinics using AI. The company is part of the Startup Accelerator and venture capital firm Y Combinator. And among its early investors is BAMCAP, formerly Beta Angels, a venture capital group. And finally, Tukey.ai from Miami, founder, CEO, Ramiro Robalos. When? 2023. Full-time employees, 20. What it does, combining AI and expert support to help immigrants and companies manage visas and green cards efficiently and providing the overall experience. The finalists for the Endeavor Miami Pitch Competition, investors include Accelerator and Incubator Tampa Bay Wave and representatives from Venture Mentoring Team. And that's all they wrote. And now, in the week ahead, Medicare Beware, a guide for enrolling by Terry Savage. Medicare's open enrollment period starts October 15. Making the correct choices when you initially sign up for Medicare and every year when you must review your drug coverage could save you a fortune or cost you a fortune. If you make a mistake, beware. Medicare is not a one-time event where you sign up and forget it. Portions of Medicare require annual review and potential changes in coverage, such as if you move to another state or if you cannot afford the premiums of the plan you initially chose. Miss a deadline and you could find yourself without coverage or paying too much. Medicare is not even a one-time age 65 event. You may delay applying for Medicare if you have comparable coverage from work or from your spouse's job, assuming that the employer's insurance does not require you to sign up at age 65. In fact, you shouldn't even sign up for the free Part A if your employer plan includes a health savings account. Medicare is complex. Traditional Medicare is a combination of Parts A, hospitalization, and B, physicians and testing, and a supplement policy, aka Medigap, to cover things like copays and the portion of care that Medicare doesn't cover, as well as a Part D drug plan required even if you don't currently take prescription medicines. Choosing a supplement is easy. You cannot be turned down for the best, most comprehensive, and most expensive plan, currently Plan G, if you sign up within 6 months of signing up for Original Medicare, even if you already have health issues. But after that initial period, you are not guaranteed the most comprehensive supplement. Once you have that comprehensive supplement, you'll want to keep it, unless you simply can't afford it. Choosing a Part D drug plan is easy and required, even if you currently don't take meds. However, you must review your Part D plan every year during open enrollment. That's because the plans change the drugs they cover, as well as the copays and the monthly premium. One saving grace is the fact that your out-of-pocket cost can never be more than $2,100 in 2026, even if you take expensive drugs. You might have to pay that amount in the first month or two, but nothing after that. The next column in this series will be about Part D. Dealing with all those moving parts is one reason more than half America's seniors have turned to Medicare Advantage all-in-one plans, which have been widely publicized. Late-night TV commercials entice people to sign up with promises of dental and vision care in Advantage plans and lower premiums. But as the government squeezes reimbursements to the plans, the mostly nonprofit insurance companies that offer them must limit care to prop up profits. And you're the one caught in the squeeze. For years, I have been warning that Advantage plans are a form of managed care, requiring permission for testing and limiting access to physicians and hospitals that are part of the group. Now many healthcare providers and hospitals are dropping out of Advantage plans because of the paperwork nightmare and the limited reimbursement. And that's all she wrote. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Sunday, October 12th, 2025 issue of the Viewpoints and also Buffalo Next section of the Buffalo News. We read from these sections of the Buffalo News every Sunday at 6 p.m. Your reader has been Robin. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the National Enquirer. At 8 p.m., we have People Magazine. And at 9 o'clock, we have the New York Times Book Review. Stay tuned for these readings and more. And if you have any comments, suggestions, or questions, please stay with us. If you're listening to this publication online, you're probably using our website, a podcast player like Spotify or iTunes, a streaming service like Siro, or a smart speaker. Did you know that we now have a dedicated app that can be downloaded to any mobile device, like a smartphone or tablet, for free? App users can conveniently access our live stream and any episode of our podcast easier than ever. To download the app, just type NFRRS in the search window in the Apple App Store or in the Google Play Store. Contact us anytime if you have any questions by calling 716-821-5555, extension 5. Thank you. The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision,